is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on a beautiful Monday here in Washington, D.C. Still a little warm, but yeah. Anyhow, the insider-outsider story that I've been telling you for a few years now is really heating up right now in a really interesting way. And there's something you need to know in order to be able to understand what is happening and why, and, well, I was going to say and the how is, I guess, fairly evident, but and why, with regard to the possibility that Joe Biden might run for president. The conventional meme, the conventional story that is out there is, well, in fact, here's from the Financial Times today, Megan Murphy in here in Washington, D.C., writing, Joe Biden, the U.S. vice president, has long been considered the Democratic Party's best plan B if Clinton and her campaign can't pull it off, if they can't make it work, if they stumble. My words. Well, stumble, actually, is from her piece. With concerns about Mrs. Clinton's falling poll numbers mounting every day, some senior Democrats believe now is the time for Joe Biden to become Plan A and are clamoring for him to jump into the race. Now, Joe Biden is 72. He's roughly, you know, he's a year younger than Bernie Sanders. So it's, you know, anybody who said, oh, Bernie, he's too old, they're going to go for Biden. So apparently age isn't a deal. Back to this article, Mrs. Clinton's gaffes on the campaign trail have alarmed many big ticket donors and even some of her own allies. I would say, for example, you know, last week when she said, well, if you want to know my position on Keystone XL, elect me president and I'll tell you. That is going to be, I think it already is. I'm sure that, you know, that her biggest backers all across the country at the time she said that were going, oh, that's good. That's just like when John Kerry said I voted for it before I voted against it. Or vice versa. Anyhow, Mrs. Clinton's gaffes on the campaign trail have alarmed many big-ticket donors, and even some of her own allies who fret that she has failed to learn the lessons of 2008 when she lost her party's nomination to Barack Obama. Now, you know, step into the Wayback Machine. What was it about Obama that caused him to beat Hillary? I don't think it was just that he was a better politician or that he gave a better speech, although I think that he gave a better speech, certainly. Whether he's a better politician or not, I don't know. I think that they're probably very much the same. But he was perceived at the time by us, by the voters, as the outsider, and Hillary Clinton was perceived as the insider. Now, what we didn't know when we went with amazing enthusiasm in 2008, I mean, people dancing their hearts out, people with tears in their eyes as Barack Obama was nominated and brought into the White House. And rightfully so. I mean, the first black president of the United States is amazingly, truly, profoundly, deeply historic. And he's still the first black president of the United States and will be forever. And he's had a very good and consequential presidency. But he was not an outsider. And that was that whole hope and change thing, was people basically were saying, we want an outsider. We want somebody who's not wed to the old politics, somebody who's not, you know, in bed with the banksters, somebody who will send the banksters who destroyed this economy. Keep in mind that happened in the months leading up to the election, in the year leading up to the election. Somebody who's destroyed this economy, who will send those banksters to jail. Somebody who will bail out the middle class. Somebody who will do something about student debt. These are issues that Barack Obama actually ran on. Somebody who will make sure that everybody has health insurance in this country. Somebody who will make sure that, you know, Medicare is a public option. These are the things that Obama ran on. They're not the things he delivered. And the reason why, in part, now a large part of the reason why, I mean, some of these things he actually tried to deliver, and Nancy Pelosi did a marvelous job, but there were only between 71 and 74 days when the Senate was not filibuster-proof. And basically during that time, they got through Obamacare and about 15 or 20 other really good programs, but not major consequential things like, you know, breaking up the big banks. So we thought we were voting for the outsider. And as I keep saying, and I think that people, it's starting to dawn on people. It's not left-right. It's not Democrat-Republican. It's not liberal, progressive, conservative, Tea Party. It's insiders versus outsiders. And on the Republican side, what has happened is that the outsiders, the Koch brothers and the billionaires, and the people like, you know, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Mike Huckabee, a whole bunch. Huckabee not so much, I suppose, but have become the outsiders. And Jeb Bush is the quintessential insider. And you're having, and the ultimate outsider on the Republican side, of course, is Donald Trump. Which brings me to Bernie Sanders. I don't think that it's Mrs. Clinton's gaffes on the campaign trail that are hurting her. In this article, it says her favorable rating among voters, favorability ratings have dipped significantly since she launched her campaign in April, with only about 40% of Americans now saying they find her honest or trustworthy. Now, they did not compare those numbers to Bernie's numbers, which are really good. Bernie is the only candidate on Republican or Democratic side who has a net positive perception among the American people. The only one. But they don't mention it in the article because, you know, the Financial Times, they're insiders, too. So she goes on to say a Biden bid for the White House would also face serious obstacles. He's run twice before in 88 and 2008, and he's currently polling in the low double digits, lagging behind Mr. Sanders. And he faces some of the same concerns about establishment connections that have plagued Mrs. Clinton. Now, this is about as close as this article gets to telling, you know, the unspeakable truth. Here's what's actually going on. The insiders in the Democratic Party, the Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her buddies, and the very wealthy people who fund the Democratic Party, who are very proud to be part of the inside. Now, there are some very wealthy party people who fund the Democratic Party who are also on the outside. But there are some, you know, and they tend to be people who have a very specific issue. They're all about climate change, or they're all about the LGBT rights, or they're all about immigration, things like that. And they typically have a personal affiliation with that issue. But the insiders, the Paul Begalas of the world, the Bob Schrums of the world, the political insiders, the Debbie Wasserman Schultzes of the world, well over half of, you know, maybe three quarters of the Democratic Party, maybe four fifths of the Democratic Party in the Senate and three quarters to two thirds in the House. There are a few outsiders among them, and Bernie is one of them. So when Bernie was asked about this on Sunday, he said, I've known Joe Biden for many years. I'm very fond of Joe, but I think the American people who are seeing the middle class in this country disappearing, massive levels of income and wealth inequality, a campaign finance system that is literally corrupt now, owned by billionaires, the American people want to go beyond conventional establishment politics. In other words, Bernie is saying, enough. The insiders have busted everything up. The insiders have ruined things. And, you know, it's very much like the mafia. And I don't mean this in the most pejorative context, but there are serious parallels to be drawn here. It's not, you know, political parties don't operate on, you know, prostitution and selling drugs like the mob does, like the mafia does. But they do operate on bribery. And the mafia, if you're a made man, if you've gone through the now I'm on the inside process, you're set for life. And it's the same way in both political parties. If you're a member of the inside, keep in mind, Bernie is one of the few guys in the Senate who's not a millionaire, much less a billionaire. If you're a made man or woman in the Democratic Party, they will always have your back, but the price of that is you always have their back. It's always the establishment. What we're looking at here is the permanent institutional insiders. And Chris Matthews went off crazy on this over the weekend. I got to play that for you after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Arguably, FDR came in as an insider, became an outsider, and the party followed him. Reagan came in as an outsider. The party followed him. Now he's viewed as an insider. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And wait a second here. How do we get to our call screen? There it is. There she be. Let's see here. Michael. In Smithfield, North Carolina. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Yes, sir, Mr. Tom Hartman. I really enjoy your show, and you put out some good information every day. And Mr. Tom Hartman, just a few minutes ago, Attorney General Ken Paxton, state of Texas, turned himself in. He surrendered a security fraud. I think it's what it was.
The state AG in the state of Texas?
Yep. It's on their local news media website right now, WFAA.com.
Okay. I'll check it out. That's fascinating.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Well, not that very often you tick me off, but it's getting to the point to where it's starting to get ridiculous. If you want to endorse Bernie Sanders, by all means, endorse Bernie. That's fine.
I have done that.
Every morning you start your show off with something to go against Hillary Clinton.
No, it's not true.
Every morning. And I'm a loyal listener, and I don't know if you do it subconsciously or consciously, but every morning you start your show off with a tirade against Hillary Clinton. And I'm sitting,
Carl, what did I say against Hillary Clinton this morning?
Every morning.
Now, what did I say against Hillary Clinton this morning?
We have Fox News. We have Fox News.
No, what did I say against Hillary Clinton, Carl?
Fox News is going to tear her down. Democrats don't need to do that.
So what did I say against Hillary Clinton?
What do you say against her?
Yeah. You're complaining that I said something that I tried to tear down Hillary Clinton. What did I say that tears down Hillary Clinton?
It's every morning.
What did I say?
You don't have to tear down Hillary Clinton to build up Bernie Sanders.
What did I say to tear down Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton will not be as bad as you make her out to be.
Carl, if you're a loyal listener, you have heard me over and over and over again say that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, I'm going to work my ass off to get her elected.
Her numbers.
You know, trying to talk over me is not going to make your point.
Of course. Go ahead.
Over and over and over again in this program, I have said that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of this party, I'm going to work my ass off to get her elected.
Right.
And I absolutely will. And I think she's a great politician, and I think she'd be a great president. I think Bernie would be a better president. But that doesn't mean that she's bad. And back to this thing. What did I say this morning that was trashing Hillary?
As soon as you let me speak. I'll tell you. You're talking about her numbers going down since she came into it. Well, fine. Most politicians' numbers do go down when they step back into the arena. These are Republican talking points, Tom.
Her numbers
are going down. You know what? If I was running for president right now in this particular environment, I would kill for her numbers.
Yeah. Her numbers are great, Carl, and the odds are that she's going to be the nominee. She's pulling well over 50% right now, and she's been stable there. I'm talking about the establishment inside the Democratic Party is talking about Joe Biden, not me. I'm not a Joe Biden fan. I mean, I like Joe, but I'm not here to promote Joe Biden. But we all need to understand the dynamic at work here. Carl, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, to my point, this is, and apropos of Carl's call just a second ago, this is not an anti-Hillary Clinton rant at all. I think it would be amazing to have a woman as a president, and Hillary Clinton is a perfect woman for that job. And she would make a very good president. There's no doubt in my mind she's not quite as far left as I'd like, but she's a hell of a lot better than frankly, most of the Democrats and any of the Republicans. So it's not even a hold your nose and vote Democratic because the Supreme Court's at stake. I'm actually enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. That said, the Democratic Party itself is starting to freak out. As the Financial Times wrote today, as Maureen Dowd in the New York Times wrote over the weekend, she's even saying that Howard Schultz, this is a New York Times columnist. This is how the establishment seeds this stuff. Saying, here, the CEO of Starbucks, he should run. He's got a rags-to-riches story. He's a rich guy. He could pull a Donald Trump and fund much of his own campaign. And he's willing to go along with the establishment. What's going on with this whole Biden thing you know, trying to draft Biden, get Biden out there, is that they're freaked out that an outsider, in this case Bernie Sanders, may end up on the inside of the Democratic Party and push the Democratic Party in a direction that will push out the billionaire donors and the big corporations. The Republicans are afraid of the exact same thing with Donald Trump, although Donald Trump presents a far less viable option, you know, if he actually were to get the nomination. I don't think he's interested in being president. He's interested in running. He's loving the spotlight. When the spotlight goes away, when the work comes, forget it. He's out of here. Donald Trump is not going to be the Republican nominee, and he's not going to be president of the United States. You can count on that. But on the Democratic side, basically what they're saying is, okay, we insiders, and the we insiders includes the insiders in the media, want this Sanders guy taken down. And Hillary doesn't seem to be taking him down. The more he goes up, the more she goes down. So maybe Joe Biden can take him down. Because the other, you know, Lincoln Chafee and Mr. Webb, Jim Webb, and Martin O'Malley, the other three Democratic nominees, they're getting no enthusiasm, and they're certainly not capable of taking down Sanders. So how about Biden? And then the chorus of insiders in the media comes in, and MSNBC has been particularly part of this. They essentially did not even report on the largest political event in the history of the United States, Bernie Sanders' house parties last Wednesday. Over 100,000 people showed up. They, by and large, don't report on what Bernie has to say, because part of what he has to say actually flies in the face of the political agenda of the company that owns MSNBC and NBC. And it flies in the face of the company that owns ABC. And it flies in the face of the company that owns CBS. You're not going to hear Bernie's message on corporate media. It ain't going to happen. Even flies in the face of the company that owns CNN. And so here is the corporate media trying to take down Bernie Sanders. Bernie has over and over and over again on this program, and I don't know if we found the clip of that this morning, but oh, that was in our TV meeting. Anyhow, over and over and over again on this program said democratic socialism is providing a strong social safety net for the poor and setting the rules of the game of business so that if you work a 40-hour week, you can make enough to not live in poverty but to live a middle-class life. It's that simple. He's not opposed to the free market. He doesn't think that the government should own everything or that the government should even regulate business all that much. Bernie does not have an argument against capitalism. But Chris Matthews wants you to think he does. So when Bernie was on, what was this, Meet the Press? Debbie Wasserman Schultz was on Meet the Press over the weekend. I'm sorry I missed it. I had to fly to Los Angeles Saturday morning, flew back Sunday morning, and so I missed the shows. But here is, you know, after Debbie Wasserman Schultz is on and Chris Matthews tries to get her to essentially complain about Bernie being a, quote, socialist, here's what he had to say. Watch this. Listen to this.
She doesn't want to answer that question.
Yeah,
why do you think that?
I think there's a big difference. I mean, socialists traditionally believe in government control of the economy, and Democrats believe in modifying the economy to help people at the bottom, a safety net, modification, but clearly they believe in the market.
Why do you think she didn't say that?
Well, politically, she doesn't want to offend the Bernie people.
You think that's the issue?
Well, I think so. And maybe there was an intellectual problem, but I will give her the benefit of the doubt and say it was really a political problem she faced, because I think Hillary Clinton hasn't staked out the difference, and she better. I mean, it's not the Democratic Socialist Party. You got to run as a Democrat, which is always harder to explain. Being a progressive or a liberal is a lot harder than just being a right winger or a left winger. You're actually somewhere center left, and it's a little harder to define. But clearly, Democrats have had a record in this country for 200 some years of being for Social Security, Medicare, civil rights, interventions in the market, but not getting rid of the market. Clearly, they accept the power and the efficiency of a capitalist system. Socialists do not. This is a fundamental difference.
Well, socialists do not. If you're talking about Chinese communism, if you're talking about the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But, you know, Chris Matthews is trying to say that Bernie Sanders doesn't believe in capitalism or the market, which is just a complete lie. I mean, you know, either Chris Matthews is profoundly ignorant, which I don't believe for a second. I think he's one of the smartest guys out there. Or this is now the leading edge of the establishment, the insider's spear that is going to be thrown against that outsider, Bernie Sanders. So just, you know, watch this space. It's going to get really, really interesting. It's happening on the Republican side, too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So we'll talk about the Republican side in the second hour of the program. I've got some thoughts on that. But it's really insiders versus outsiders here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. William Grider wrote a piece for The Nation that indirectly speaks to this very issue that I'm talking about, which is the insiders versus the outsiders. I'm going to pick up your phone calls in just a moment. It is Anything Goes Summer, but I really wanted to kind of awaken you to this. We thought Barack Obama was an outsider. We voted him in as an outsider, but he was really an insider all along. He basically had been taken under Bill Clinton's wing, you know, when he gave the DNC speech. The powers that be worked miracles to get him into the Senate. He was in the Senate only a few months before they started running him for president. He was the insider's nominee, but he ran on a platform of being an outsider. It worked, and it worked because it had been tried before. It was tried in 1992 by Bill Clinton, who ran on an outsider's campaign platform, which was called the New Covenant Speech, which I reprint in my book Threshold, The Crisis of Western Civilization. And you can probably find on the internet without too much trouble. Bill Clinton's New Covenant speech was essentially saying we need to reject Reaganism and go back to the wisdom of FDR and John Maynard Keynes. We need to take America back before the Reagan Revolution. But as has been famously documented in dozens of places by people much more competent than I as reporters, you know, in the weeks leading up to his inauguration, when candidate Bill Clinton became president-elect Bill Clinton, Larry Summers and, who was the bankster? It wasn't Jamie Dimon. It was, Summers and two other guys sat Clinton down and said, son, you may think that you are the populist president and that you were elected on this platform of, you know, dramatic change, but that's not how you're going to govern. Not if you want to be on the inside. Not if you want to have the assistance of Congress. Not if you want to have the assistance of the corporate system. The inside, you know, it's like the mafia. And I don't mean that in the bad way. I mean that in the organizational way. It's structured. And most companies are, by the way. I mean, you've got insiders in companies and outsiders in companies. And it's the insiders who rise up through the ranks. And it's the outsiders who stand on the outside wondering why they get passed over for promotion, even if they're smarter, even if they make better contributions. It's knowing how to play the game. I've been given several opportunities in the course of my life since I started this program, 12, 13 years, or however long ago it was. I've been given several opportunities to essentially become an insider, invited to the White House, invited to, I need not go through it all. But I chose from the very beginning that I was never going to be an insider. I wanted to maintain my own integrity. I did not want to be dependent upon party structure or political structure. Now, you will find other people in the media on so-called left-wing radio and TV who have decided that they want to become part of the inside. They don't want to be an outsider. And so those people will not talk about using their media platforms. They will not talk about our insane trade policies because that's something that's very important to the insiders. They make a lot of money off our trade policies. They will not talk about net neutrality. That's something that's very important to the insiders, these big corporations that basically own our media now. They don't want net neutrality. So you will not hear Democrats and liberals who are insiders talk about those things. You won't hear Hillary Clinton talk about those things. You won't hear them talk about the TPP. You won't hear them talk about Keystone XL because these are issues that have to do with an enormous amount of money going to the insiders. And if you start talking about them, then immediately the power structure, and it's not like some weird conspiracy, but it's there. And you can just watch somebody on television for 2 minutes and know, insider or outsider? Harry Ford Jr., insider. Michael Steele, insider. Well, virtually every guest that you see on CNN or MSNBC is an insider. And the insider message is, right now, you know, we want to elect Hillary Clinton, and we're very concerned on the Democratic side. As I said, I'm going to talk about the Republican side the next hour. But the insider message on the Democratic side is Hillary Clinton has been an insider from day one. Her husband's been an insider. He ended welfare as we know it. He brought us free trade, NAFTA and CAFTA. He deregulated the banks. He did a lot of stuff that helped the insiders. Now, he governed in a fairly, you know, moderate way. He governs just slightly to the right of Dwight Eisenhower, who was, by the way, I would say probably the last outsider president on the Republican side. Although you could argue that Reagan was elected as an outsider and then became an insider. And then his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, was the ultimate insider. I mean, his father had been a United States senator. In fact, got busted by FDR for dealing with the Nazis after we were already in World War II. But it's, you know, this is the question, how the Democratic Party lost its soul. And apparently, the insider attack, or at least Chris Matthews' version of it, assuming that Chris is smart enough to know that in the democratic socialist countries like Denmark and Norway and Sweden and Finland, I mean, you ever heard of IKEA? It's not owned by the government. You ever heard of Volvo? It's not owned by the government. You ever heard of Siemens, you know, the democratic company, country of Germany? You know, they manufacture half the equipment you'll find in a hospital, not owned by the government. All of these countries, Germany, France, Norway, Sweden, all of the Northern European countries, in fact, probably most of the European countries, would define themselves as democratic socialist countries. And in fact, the United States, since the FDR administration, has been a democratic socialist country. Social Security is democratic socialist. Medicare is democratic socialist. Medicaid is democratic socialist. These are basically, it's where we say, okay, what are the appropriate boundaries between the commons, the things that we all collectively own and administer, and the private industry sphere? What are the appropriate lines? And democratic socialists place them in a slightly, very slightly different place than insider mainstream Democrats do. Insider mainstream Democrats will say, oh, sure, it's fine that half the electricity in the United States is produced by for-profit companies. Democratic socialists will say, you know, electricity is a natural monopoly. It should be run by the community. The community should own it. And in fact, if the democratic socialist perspective had prevailed, right now, President Obama wouldn't be facing a lawsuit from the trade association for the for-profit electric companies who are all hysterical and angry about him for increasing for tightening up the air pollution rules. You understand what I'm saying? This is now. So the question I've been asking on this program for weeks now, since Bernie's really taken off, is when will the insiders really go to attack him? Because first they tried to ignore him, as Gandhi pointed out. First they just, it's a media blackout. Well, they're maintaining that media blackout. Then they tried ridiculing him. Oh, you know, he's too old. He's too rumpled. Look at his hair. And then they tried attacking him. And this is, you know, I want to play this Chris Matthews clip one more time. This, or at least the last half of it. I don't know if you can easily do that, Jim, but we can play the whole thing, whatever's easier for you. Here's Chris Matthews pretending that he's ignorant about the difference between democratic socialism and Soviet-style socialism, and implying that Bernie is a Soviet socialist, which he is not. Here he is.
She doesn't want to answer that question.
Yeah,
why do you think that?
I think there's a big difference. I mean, socialists traditionally believe in government control of the economy, and Democrats believe in modifying the economy to help people at the bottom, a safety net, modification, but clearly they believe in the market.
Why do you think she didn't say that?
Well, politically, she doesn't want to offend the Bernie people.
You think that's the issue?
Well, I think so. And maybe there was an intellectual problem, but I will give her the benefit of the doubt and say it was really a political problem she faced, because I think Hillary Clinton hasn't staked out the difference, and she better. I mean, it's not the Democratic Socialist Party. You got to run as a Democrat, which is always harder to explain. Being a progressive or a liberal is a lot harder than just being a right winger or a left winger. You're actually somewhere center left, and it's a little harder to define. But clearly, Democrats have had a record in this country for 200 some years of being for Social Security, Medicare, civil rights, interventions in the market, but not getting rid of the market. Clearly, they accept the power and the efficiency of a capitalist system. Socialists do not. This is a fundamental difference.
Yes, so socialists in the old Soviet Union do not. But Bernie Sanders does. And by the way, the Democratic Party has not represented those values for 200 years. It's essentially only represented those values since 1933, since the election of Franklin Roosevelt. Prior to that, the Democratic Party was the party of the plutocrats, and as was the Republican Party from the 1870s forward. I mean, you had both parties during the Gilded Age who were in bed with the billionaires. And it was the party of slavery. The Democratic Party started out as the party of the plantation owners. And Thomas Jefferson founded it. Now, it had some high ideals, but it was, you know, it was the party of the slaveholders. It was the party of segregation. George Wallace was a Democrat. Segregation now, segregation today, segregation yesterday, segregation today, segregation forever. Right? George Wallace's campaign platform, as it were. He was a Democrat. That was the Democratic Party in the, you know, up until the 60s, up until Lyndon Johnson. Well, actually, up until the 30s, with regard to everything except race. And with regard to race, since the 60s, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, among other things. So, anyhow, enough of that. We've only got 5 seconds? 30 seconds. So I'll just finish this rant because we don't have enough time and I'll pick up your calls after the break. But this is what we're seeing right now in both parties. It's operating in a somewhat different fashion in the Republican Party. As I said, I'll talk about that in the next hour. But in the Democratic Party, what you're looking at is not that Bernie's too far left or that Hillary is too far left or too far right. It's not. You notice that conversation that Chris Matthews had with Chuck Todd and that they had with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. It was free of policy. They were not discussing issues. They were discussing what brand. Chris Matthews was essentially saying to Hillary Clinton, "You need to brand Hillary. You need to brand Bernie as a socialist." And I'm telling you, among people of Chris Matthews' age and my age, that might work to some extent. But for the millennials, they don't care.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, polls show that among millennials, socialist is actually a good word. You know, it's associated with genuine hope and change. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Willis in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Willis, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Second time calling you. I like your show.
Well, thank you.
Hey, Tom, I watch a lot of news, and when I sit back and watch what's going on, I look at immigration. Is my understanding is that immigration was passed through the Senate, Comprehensive Immigration, and it failed in the House. Why is that not being told to the public?
It was for one day, Willis. We've got this 24-hour news cycle where, you know, they're always on to the next shiny trinket, you know, the bright and shiny spangly thing. And the reason why is because we don't have news in this country anymore. We have infotainment. It only makes it onto the news programs if it will sell advertising, if it draws eyeballs, which increases the price of advertising. Back to you, Willis.
Okay, but now when you look at the president, you look at how the Mexicans are looking at him. They're calling him the chief for ousting.
The deporter in chief, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
They are not even understanding what's going on because the media is not making it known to them as what happened.
Yeah.
In Congress.
Yeah, it was Republican obstructionism. The Republicans, this is why I'm unwilling to say that Barack Obama's presidency has not met the goals that he set for it when he was campaigning. Because in many ways it has not, but I don't think that it's his fault. I think it's because of that caucus room conspiracy. You had these Republicans who got together the night he was inaugurated, and Kevin McCarthy was among them, and he's the number two guy right now in the House of Representatives. And you know, you have a bunch of senators, including DeMint, who is now running the Heritage Foundation next door to us, and they swore a blood oath to block everything that Obama wanted to do, even if it was stuff they wanted to do. If it would look like an Obama victory, they would suddenly become opposed to it. And that's what they've done for 6 years.
Well, Tom, my son is 42 years old, and me and him debate for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So he's coming to the point that both parties are the same.
Well, they're not. They're really not. The Republican Party embraces the Scalia worldview. You know, that the corporation should be ascended over everything else, and that and should have rights of people and all that kind of stuff. And the Democratic Party, there's a faction within the Democratic Party that embraces that. It's called the Blue Dog Caucus. And there's about 40 of them in the House of Representatives, and they recently voted for the TPA, you know, for fast track and stuff like that. But, you know, 40 out of, you know, roughly 200 Democrats doesn't mean that the majority of the Democratic Party is identical to the Republican Party. It's just a small caucus within the Democratic Party that's roughly
that
equivalent.
Cancer to the Democratic Party, though.
I'm sorry, say it again.
That's what he's seeing.
He's seeing what?
He's seeing like those blue dog Democrats is like a cancer to the Democratic Party.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And they make it very difficult to govern the Democratic Party. And they make it very difficult to advance any kind of a progressive agenda. On the other hand, a friend of mine is a blue dog Democrat, and his argument is he's out of Congress now. He lives where we live, and we have these conversations. And his argument is, well, you know, they get elected in states that would not elect a progressive. Would you rather have a Republican in that seat? And my answer is, no, I'm not. I'd rather not have a Republican. And he's like, well, then you got to have the blue dogs. I fundamentally disagree. I think that a progressive actually probably could get elected, but time will tell. Willis, thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, you know, this is a really interesting topic, but my own opinion about this is, you know, I think Bernie Sanders represents the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party when you look at the consolidation of corporate power in government across the world. This is a phenomenon that is happening in Europe, and it's happening here. And you know what? Guess what? We feel disempowered. When I voted for Bill Clinton, I wanted a change. Yeah. When I voted for Barack Obama, I was ecstatic. I was one of those people that was crying. I was one of those people that, you know, was really happy. We're going to get rid of this whole regime, the national security state, Guantanamo Bay. We're going to have single payer. You know, I was hoping for all those things, and then the reality hits. And, you know, I could see that, you know, I don't know if it's Barack Obama or they sit them down and they say, this is the way it is. And they throw out the Democratic Party, throws out a few crumbs and expects us to be happy. Well, we're not happy.
Yeah. You know, the last Democrat who I think was elected as an outsider, and it was in the throes of the disgust over the Reagan, over the Nixon situation. Was Jimmy Carter. And I think the party really didn't defend him that much as president, and certainly in the last, you know, 6 months or so as he was running against Ronald Reagan, because he was perceived as an outsider. And guess what? Jimmy Carter's been an outsider ever since he left office. He's not giving speeches and making $30,000-$40,000 or $300,000-$400,000 or millions. He's building houses for Habitat for Humanity. The Carter Center is doing good work around the world.
You know, yeah, I mean, what we have seen, what has transpired here is a whole movement of power away from the people to these corporations for the reasons that you just stated. And, you know, we need to have an idealistic person to, you know, have our back, and then we need to have their back. You've raised the issue, very important. If Bernie Sanders isn't elected, let's think of this as a movement.
Right.
We can actually get rid of this situation. I mean, this is a worldwide thing. They've consolidated them and the rest of us.
And
how stupid and how arrogant. But, of course, they're in power. They can't really see it, can they?
I agree. And if we build a movement, and the movement is large enough and broad enough and strong enough, and Bernie's building that movement right now, and Hillary Clinton is the nominee and becomes president, that movement... I've said this many times in this program. I don't think that Hillary is as, quote, corrupt as FDR was when he became president. That movement could push her to become the next FDR just as easily as Bernie Sanders could be the next FDR.
Sure.
Let us not give up hope, but let us organize, damn it.
Yeah, and the key is, you know, to change the Democratic Party, to change the structure, because I myself, I was involved in the Socialist Alternative Party because of Sharma Sawant. I thought, wow, this is really great. You know, and then I realized that these people have no power. It's like a club. You go and you meet, and what do you do? You do nothing.
Right. You sit around and complain. And yeah. And complaining isn't enough. There's real power in the Democratic Party. There's real power in the Republican Party. Our system of government is set up so that we essentially are stuck with a two-party system. So the Koch brothers, and this was going to be my next hour rant, but the Koch brothers sat around and said, okay, here, you know, after David Koch unsuccessfully ran for vice president in 1980 on a libertarian ticket, they said, screw this libertarian thing. We're going to take over the Republican Party. And they've damn near done it. And nothing like that has happened on the Democratic side, except right now, this rise of Bernie Sanders, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. It also happened, you know, a couple years back with Howard Dean, but the media took him down. And and now here with Chris Matthews this weekend, I think that we're seeing the tip of the spear of the media trying to take down Bernie Sanders. John, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. From John to John. John in Kansas City, Missouri, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, John, what's up?
Agreeing with most of the callers today, my whole thought right now is, even if Bernie Sanders is elected president, is it going to be another 4 or 8 years of a do-nothing Congress?
I think not, because Bernie knows how to use the podium. Bernie knows how to fire people up. And this is what, in my opinion, if there's a failure to the first 4 years of the Obama administration, it was the failure of the president to use the bully pulpit that he had. And I think it's because he was relatively new to politics and he didn't understand how this town works. And also he had a whole bunch of very cautious old Clinton advisors with him. And so they were looking at his reelection. And so they were saying, like, don't rock the boat. Take your first 4 years. Take it slow. And he followed their advice. And I think it was a mistake. I sat in a meeting in the White House with one of the senior White House officials and said as much at the end of the first year of the Obama presidency, and they basically said, okay, thank you very much, we're done with you. And you know, and I never got invited back. And I understand, you know, they don't want to hear from outsiders. But I don't think that Bernie would have an unsuccessful presidency if he was elected. I think that, you know, there's enough populist push behind him. And this is the same thing with the first year. You need to study the first year of the FDR presidency. And the best lens to look at that through is Frances Perkins, the woman that he made the Secretary of Labor, who invented the New Deal. In fact, there's a new book out about her. It's actually 2 or 3 years old, but there's a book out about Frances Perkins that is the best, you know, looking at the New Deal book I've read. That's called The Woman Who Invented the New Deal, as I recall. If you just, you know, go to Amazon and plug Frances Perkins in, it'll pop right up. But I think that that's what it is. And I agree with you. We need Bernie because he represents he's not anti-establishment like Chris Matthews is trying to portray him. He's not suggesting that corporations should come under the purview of government like Chris Matthews is trying to suggest. He's an FDR Democrat. He's the FDR wing of the Democratic Party, him and Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and Peter DeFazio and Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva and Jan Schakowsky. I mean, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus, which Bernie created in the House of Representatives back 20, 30 years ago, is alive and well. There are a lot of progressives there, but they're all viewed by the insider Democrats as outsiders. And so, you know, when Jan Schakowsky, thanks for the call, John, when Jan Schakowsky offers a budget, as she did this year and she did last year, and we had her on the program both times, a balanced budget over a 10-year period that would move America in a very progressive direction. When, you know, the Republicans took Paul Ryan's budget, everybody knows about it. Nobody knows about the Democratic, the Progressive Caucus budget, because it's not the institutional party.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, I was talking about insiders and outsiders in the Democratic Party to begin with, and how when voters are given the opportunity to vote for what they think is an outsider or an outsider message, they will do it. And did it with Bill Clinton and did it with Barack Obama. But what they got in both cases was insiders, which isn't a terrible thing. The Democratic insiders govern a hell of a lot better than the Republicans do. But this is just how it is, and the outsiders tend to literally be on the outside. They tend to be relatively disempowered and you know, not get the prime committee positions and you know, not be the ones that are put up on television every single day You want to know who the Republican insiders are? Just look at who shows up on Meet the Press. Same thing with the Democratic Party. The people who are regularly on television are the insiders. You don't hear from the outsiders. So, you know, I mean, when was the last time? There's a Tea Party caucus, but they're kind of, so let's talk about the Republican Party. Back around the time that Obama was being elected, the Koch brothers and other right-wing billionaires were looking at the American political landscape, and they were saying, you know, there's a lot of, and I don't want to attribute this specifically to the Koch brothers, but, you know, just there were people on the economic insiders in the Republican Party who were looking at the Obama presidency and who were offended by the possibility of, A, it's a Democrat. He may even put somebody on the Supreme Court who will tip the balance, because the Supreme Court, ever since the Rehnquist Court, has been wholly corporate, wholly insiders, right? Wholly and completely, totally in the bag for the big corporations and the billionaires. The Supreme Court has been all about the insiders. Institutions over people. Money over the poor, corporations and corporate rights over the rights of individuals, protecting political insiders against political outsiders. That has been the story of the Supreme Court. And Democrats tend to appoint people to the court, and the court is now the strongest, the most powerful of the three branches of government as a result of it claiming that power for itself and Congress not pushing back, which it has the right to do, but it has failed to do. It's a whole separate argument that, you know, Mike Huckabee and I agree on, oddly enough. But the point that I'm making here is that with the Republican Party, around the time of the election of Obama, the institutional insider Republican Party, the Bob Dole Republican Party, the John McCain Republican Party, who tried to pretend he was an outsider when he had been an outsider his whole entire life, you know, married a billionaire, you know, on and on it goes, right? The institutional Republican Party came into the crosshairs of a group of very, very wealthy people who said, you know, the Republican Party just isn't enough for us. They're not doing it. And we're politically smart enough to know that the American people are fed up with it. The American people are fed up with both parties. The American people are fed up with the consequences of 30-plus years of Reaganomics, destroying the working class, destroying the average working person, sending our jobs overseas, maintaining high levels of poverty in the South, competing one state against the other to get, you know, to who can give the most tax breaks. And the Republican Party looked at this and said, you know, we don't want to change that stuff. We want to keep people poor. We want to have even more poverty in the United States because it's easy to manipulate and control poor people, and particularly to get them to vote Republican. All you got to do is throw, you know, a good abortion debate at them or put a monument to the Ten Commandments up, and boom, you've got them. It's not that we want to change those things. It's that we know that the people want to change those things. So we've got to create a phony movement that will cause the people to believe that will be a point of entry, a place where the outsider voters who are sick and tired of the inside Republican Party, who are sick and tired of the corruption in the Republican Party, the Republican voters I'm talking about here, my dad's cohorts, my late father's cohorts, the institutional Republican Party, we need to reach out to them in a way that makes them feel like they've got an outsider, too. And so, you know, this very well-orchestrated rollout of the Tea Party. The Tea Party was originally invented by the PR firm that was working on behalf of the tobacco companies back in the 80s. They literally, yeah, they trademarked the name and got the websites and everything, right? And there was going to be this Tea Party against tobacco. Well, that never went anywhere. The tobacco industry, you know, got attacked in court and lost. And basically, you know, in a course of less than 5 years, the tobacco lobby went from being the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. to one of the least powerful. And so this whole Tea Party machine that was conceived for the tobacco industry became conceived for basically the finance industry, the banksters, and the oil barons. So you had the Kochs, and you had all these billionaires on Wall Street, and they get their front man, Rick Santelli, and he says, we need a tea party on television. And what was the context in which he made those remarks? These moochers who are complaining that their mortgages are going to, that they can't pay their mortgages. To hell with these working people. That, I mean, go back and watch Rick Santelli's original rant. That's what it was about. He was calling people who got screwed by the banks on their mortgages losers and whiners. Maybe not those exact words, but that was the gist of it. And saying, we need a revolt, we need a tea party, and boom, out rolls the tea party. And where do these $300,000 buses that are all painted fancy and the bus people to the events, where are they coming from? Nobody knows. Well, now we have a pretty good idea. It's the right-wing billionaires. But they kind of lost control of the Tea Party along the way. I mean, they successfully harnessed that grassroots energy, but then the Tea Partiers started saying, you know, we're sick and tired of these trade deals, too. Now, the Tea Partiers haven't yet gotten to the point where they're saying, you know, we're sick and tired of being poisoned by Coke refineries and Coke paper mills. You know, we're sick and tired of you know, the billionaires playing the finance game and screwing us and stealing our pensions. The Tea Partiers haven't yet gotten to that point, although those sentiments are widespread among the Tea Party. And if you speak to those sentiments, as Bernie Sanders is doing, what happens is you get a bunch of Tea Partiers following you because they're the outsiders in the Republican Party. And so there's this huge number of people who kind of got activated by the Koch's AstroTurf Tea Party. And now they're out there saying, we're looking for outsider candidates. We're sick and tired of the inside. You know, Ronald Reagan warned us about the inside. He said, the 9 most dangerous words in the American language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. We need outsiders, not insiders. And ever since the 1980s, Republicans have competed with each other to say who more hates government more than the other guy, which is code for I'm an outsider, not an insider. I'm not part of that giant government bureaucracy that's beholden to the giant corporations. But the reality is that they all are. George W. Bush, the ultimate insider. I had a conversation over the weekend with an old friend who's very wise politically, ran for Congress once, who said, you know, and who had just watched the movie about my old friend Vince Bugliosi put together, you know, the prosecution of American president, and said, you know, why is nobody doing this? Why is nobody holding Bush accountable? And my answer is really easy, because he's an insider. And the entire institutional inside is going to protect him no matter what. He will be protected and enriched until the day he dies. Bill Clinton's become an insider. But I'm talking about the Republican Party here. Here you've got a grassroots movement that wants an outsider. And how is that manifesting itself right now? Two words. Donald Trump. By the way, did you know that the first Republican debate is tonight on C-SPAN? You won't hear about it in the corporate media because nobody can make any money on it. But it's going to be tonight on C-SPAN. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, last hour, the Democratic Party, insiders and outsiders. This hour, insiders and outsiders in the Republican Party. Your thoughts and calls. It's anything goes summer after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And let's see here. Tim in Toledo, Ohio. Hey, Tim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. It's good. I've been waiting for a while, but I'm thankful to be on the Tom Hartman Show. I love your show, man.
Thank you.
But listen, my question was, I got a couple questions and comments because I've been listening. And one thing was, do you really feel like an outsider under the current establishment, the way that they do things, and just the way it's set up, can actually get in? I just don't think that the insiders are going to allow that. And
I agree.
If they do.
Well, Tim, this is a variation on the question I asked Jimmy Carter, which, you know, Jimmy Carter was on the show last Tuesday, and he said America is now an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery. And I said, what's going to change that? And he said it's going to take a horrible event. It's going to take some shameful, despicable event that so creates such revulsion among the American people and in Congress and in the Supreme Court that the institutions will wake up and things will change. And I think, and this is why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2016, I think that event is going to be an economic crash. And I think if that crash comes in the next 4 or 5 or 6 months before the Democratic primary, that Bernie Sanders has the highest probability of being the Democratic nominee. And if he's not, I think Hillary is going to start adopting some of these outsider populist perspectives, and she'll be the Democratic nominee, or Joe Biden for that matter, whoever it is. They're going to have to start taking these positions. If there's not a crash, Tim, you may well be right. The institutional inside may be too powerful.
That makes sense. Now, Tom, there's one place where I can't say I fully disagree with you, because I've been a little disappointed as far as President Obama is concerned, but I really feel like, I believe that when he was running as an outsider, I feel like there was a part of him that really was an outsider that he had, because when you listen to his passionate speeches, he was on the outside.
Oh, yeah. You read his biography, his autobiographies. They're the story of an outsider. Absolutely.
Yeah. And now here's the other thing. I feel like if they do get in, I would love to think that Hillary could get in and say, okay, now I'm in, and now I'm going to do some things that the outsiders would really do. But what I think about is, whereas when Barack Obama got in and Boehner and his boys stated, like you talked about earlier, the blood oath against him.
Right. This man will have no legacy. Right.
Anyway. And then, but see, that they could do because he was a black president. He was black. Whereas if Hillary got in, it'd be hard for them to say, well, we're going to stand against her because she's as a white female, because now half of every party is going to be a white female. And now you got half the party looking and say, wait a second, Jim, you're going to.
Tim, women still earn 73% of men in this economy. It's not as bad for white women as it is for black men, but it's better for black men than it is for black women. There is a hierarchy, a pecking order, as it were, tragically. And I would not misunderestimate, to use a Sarah Palinism, the power of misogyny, of men who either hate or are afraid of powerful women.
Hate. That's true. I got one more question for you now. And again,
we're just about out of time, Tim.
Okay. When you talk about Bernie's not against the market. Somebody should be against the market. It's corrupt too.
Well, Bernie's against an abusive marketplace, and that's what we have. This whole laissez-faire capitalism, you know, anything goes capitalism, unregulated capitalism. He's opposed to that, and I think most thinking Americans are. Tim, thank you for the call. A lot of great points. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. It's your media support group for We the People. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. So that's my riff on the Republican Party. And it's, as I pointed out, the first Republican debate is actually tonight on C-SPAN. They're calling it a forum, right? But it's and only three of the candidates are not going to be there. So it's, say what? Yeah, they're coming up one at a time. It's not going to be a debate. It's a forum. It's like, okay, what are your positions? What are your positions? What are your positions? But it's going to be interesting. And it's getting no publicity whatsoever because, you know, they can't sell commercial advertising. There's no money in it. And C-SPAN, by the way, is part of the outside. Right? C-SPAN is the necessary evil that came along with cable companies running their wires through the commons. They run their wires through our neighborhoods. They run them through our streets, under our streets, over our streets, and we pay to maintain them. And so in exchange for the cable companies using our commons, they all have to kick in a small amount of money to C-SPAN, and that's how C-SPAN is funded. C-SPAN was, you know, when cable was growing and Congress said, okay, we got to regulate cable somehow because it's growing like a weed, This was a variation on the old fairness doctrine, which was if you're using a radio or television over the air, you've got to do a public service. And the public service was you got to program in the public good. And that public good was you have to have real news. Well, Reagan ended that in 87. But C-SPAN was the, you know, with regard to cable television, C-SPAN was the same thing. Basically, you've got to have, you know, real public affairs programming. Now, you don't have to do it on your network. You don't have to do it on CNN or MSNBC or Fox or ABC or CNN or Showtime or HBO. You don't have to do it on your network. You just have to do it on the cable structure. So we'll invent this C-SPAN thing and stick it off here on the corner. But they're essentially the outsiders. And they do a lot of really good outsider programming. But, you know, you got to work for C-SPAN. You know, I have a friend who applied for a job over at C-SPAN recently in the production staff, you know, as a producer. And, you know, they don't pay that well. They don't pay as well as commercial television. Their stars are not multimillionaires. It's sort of like Free Speech TV. Free Speech TV is the outsiders, right? Nobody's getting rich at Free Speech TV. In fact, you know, a lot of people are getting absolutely nothing. And you know, who are chipping in. And it's a fine thing. We need more of these outsider voices. We need to strengthen the outsider voices. This program is, I am an outsider. I have chosen to be an outsider, an outsider voice. And you can figure out who's the insiders and who's the outsiders. But it shouldn't be a war against the two. It's like, again, to the point of the Republicans, the outsiders, the Kochs and the billionaires, they decided, we're going to take control of the insiders. We are going to infiltrate and take over the Republican Party. And, you know, we've done entire programs on this back a year, 2 years ago about the DVDs and the YouTubes that were passed around to all these Tea Party groups back in 2008, 2009, and early 2010 as we came up to the 2010 election. To how you, Mr. and Mrs. Tea Partier, you should join the local Republican Party. It wasn't the Concord Coalition. It was the Concord something. Remember what it was, Shane? And they've got the YouTubes are all still up there. You can find them. Where they say, you know, the guy said, in fact, we've got a whole clip sheet of them, a whole set of clips of them. I don't know if you can easily find them. Pardon? The Concord Project. Thank you, Shana. And, you know, in one of the clips, the guy says, you know, the most powerful person in the United States is not the president. It's the precinct committee person in the Republican Party. It's not the member of the Senate or the House. It's the precinct committee people. They are the most powerful people in American politics. Why? Because they write the party platform and because they choose the nominees for the primaries. And so if you and your friends can all be precinct committee persons and you can control more than 50% of the people in your local Republican precinct, and we're talking at the very local level, then you can help make sure that only Tea Partiers are nominated for this particular congressional race. So it looks like there's a choice to the Republican voters. Hey, there's five different names on the ballot, but every single one of them represents the billionaires. Every single one of them is a Tea Partier. And they were very successful in 2010. So successful, they flipped a bunch of states. They were able to use the census of 2010 for redistricting and reapportioning to make a Democrat-free House of Representatives. Even though Democrats got more than half the votes, they got 5 million more votes than Republicans did in the last two elections. In the House of Representatives, and yet the House is still controlled by the Republicans. Why is that? Because of gerrymandering. What made the gerrymandering possible? This takeover of the Republican Party. Why is it that there are over 100 members of the House of Representatives who are new members in the last two election cycles who all deny climate change exists? Because the Tea Party, you know, the Tea Party is totally beholden to the Koch brothers. Without them, it wouldn't exist. And what's the business that the Koch brothers inherited from their daddy? Oil! These are fossil fuel billionaires. They make their living poisoning the planet. So they said, we're going to take over the institution, the insiders. These people who think they're insiders, we're going to make them run for their lives. We're going to make them run for the hills, or else go along with us. And that's what you're seeing in the Republican Party right now. You know, Jeb Bush is about the only insider left. Scott Walker is being represented as an outsider. He is. He's beholden to the Koch brothers. But the insiders increasingly in the Republican Party are the old outsiders. There are no outsiders in the Republican Party outside of, you know, the Rand Paul coalition who are talking about, you know, less foreign entanglement and let's legalize drugs and prostitution. You know, the cream of the libertarian rants. And it's going nowhere. Rand Paul is you know, he's imploding. Because the insiders in the Republican Party have been taken over by the billionaires. They used to be the outsiders. So if Bernie were to become president, it would be part of a much larger wave on the Democratic side that would be the outsiders taking over the Democratic Party as well. And then we'd have a really interesting, genuine, and honest debate in this country. And we may have it whether it's Bernie or not. We'll see how the times go. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And as President Carter said last Tuesday, and as I've been saying for years, I wrote my book, Crash of 2016. It's going to take a really big event to make it happen, and I have a feeling one's coming. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm telling you, it's all insiders versus outsiders. You look at the media. You look at this is, you know, this is one of the reasons I think that Glenn Beck got, you know, driven out of Fox News. He got way too outsider. I mean, he was crazy. I mean, sometimes you look at the people who are on the outside and you say, well, they're on the outside because of a reason. But more often than not, the people who are on the outside are the people who are the disenfranchised, essentially. African Americans, for example, how, you know, it's just in the last decade or so that you're starting to see black faces on television, particularly for women, beautiful black faces. I remember Dick Gregory saying back, you know, this is back in the 70s, making this comment to me about how you know, when he was growing up, the only black face that he ever saw in the media was Aunt Jemima, and he said, "There's no way I thought Aunt Jemima was sexy." So the standards of beauty were set even for young black men. And now you've got Kerry Washington and all. I mean, it's all, you know, it's starting to change. And what's happening is, you know, a number of African-Americans who used to be on the outside have jumped on the inside. And you see like Michael Steele in the Republican Party. But there's also, you know, a large segment of the African-American population is still outsiders. It's the same with Latinos. Same with gays. It's, you know, the quintessential insiders from the beginning have been white males who started and controlled this country and supervised the genocide of the Indians and the enslavement of African Americans and women. And they're starting to lose power rapidly. And it's freaking some of them out, which is why you're seeing, you know, the rise of the white supremacist movement. And it's really not just white supremacists, it's white male supremacists. But I wander far afield, and it's anything goes summer. So let's pick up your calls, Chuck in Westport, Washington. Hey Chuck, what's up?
Hey Tom, great show today. Really moving stuff.
Thank you.
I've been listening for a bit. Yeah. So this is anything goes summer. And one thing that I've noticed, and this is a post 9/11, it has been bothering me for, well, I guess now like 14 years. The emergence of the American flag pin as a piece of the uniform of a political person, and I want to say that it's neo-McCarthyism.
Yeah. Well, certainly nationalism. Do you remember when Barack Obama was running for president and he wasn't wearing the flag pin? And John McCain started attacking him for it, and the media started asking him, you know, why aren't you wearing the flag pin? Do you hate this country? And all of a sudden he started wearing the flag pin and continues to this day. It's just become sort of de rigueur. If I'm pronouncing that right, it's the stuff that you've got to do. It's just like you've got to honor the troops, even though you don't, you know, raise their pay or you don't offer them better benefits. I mean, it's insane that we have charities raising money to help wounded veterans. We should be doing that. But still all these politicians just give all this lip service to it. So I think it's a symptom of phony nationalism, of pseudo nationalism.
And then the last thing is, my wife, who's Canadian, actually, put a foot in my mouth on this one. What would be more Bush era American than wearing the American flag pin that is made in China?
Right. Right.
You can actually, she found it online, you can buy a union-made, American-made American flag pin.
Huh.
So, that being said, I'm doing some work for Bernie, and I didn't want to make this a big you know, Go Bernie ad, but I say, you know, if you're going to wear it, then you better, you know, wear the union-made, American-made, American flag pin.
There you go, Chuck. Thanks very much. This it reminds me of, you know, Bernie's campaign now in all the Smithsonian museums here in town. I mean, D.C. is the tourist paradise because they're all free, and there's 34 of them, and they're awesome. And they all have gift shops, and most of the stuff in the gift shops is made in China. And you know, Bernie's been going after them for years on that. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. James in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, James. What's up?
Tom?
Yeah.
I just wanted to share a story with you that I thought you might find a bit sad. And goes along with your theme today. After listening to your program maybe about 10 days ago, I decided to contact the DNC and urge them to schedule the Democratic debates, you know, because we need to offer a clear voice, an alternative to the Republicans.
Right.
So since contacting them, I've received three emails. One was, please donate and enter a contest to win a trip to the summer meetings in Minnesota. The second was, please sign Barack Obama's birthday card. And then the third was from Barack Obama to please enter that contest to win a trip to Minnesota because it's going to be great.
Right.
So I think that goes along with your show because, you know, they're like giving us a chance to win a lottery, to become an insider for a day or a lunch with Hillary.
Yeah, that was the Hillary Clinton week before last was, you know, enter the lottery to have lunch with Hillary. Last week it was send us a dollar and we'll send you a credit card. Not a real credit card, but we'll send you an affiliate card or a status card or something. And I don't think that's how you win elections. And I think the Democratic Party is making a horrible mistake by not going full populist this time around. And the Republican Party, is going to make that mistake, which concerns me tremendously for the election coming up. James, excellent points. Thank you for the calling and making them. Taylor in San Jose, California. Hey, Taylor, what's up?
Hey, I just had a couple of comments and a question that you kind of already answered it. First of all, I live in the Bay Area, which is pretty progressive, and there's two types of progressive liberals here. There's those that love Bernie, he's their favorite candidate, and they're going to work for him. And then there's those that love Bernie, and he's their favorite candidate, but he can't win. And then end of discussion.
Right.
Also, I find it very, you know, odd that they always drop Democratic socialists. When they speak about it, it's always socialist, not democratic socialist.
Right. And Chris Matthews, I think, was just astonishingly disingenuous, fundamentally dishonest by arguing that Bernie is a socialist. The New York Times does it. Everybody who does it. I think it's wrong because Bernie is a democratic socialist. He's not a, you know, socialism means a lot of things, but democratic socialism means something very specific. It's the form of governance that you see in Northern Europe. And I don't think that Chris Matthews is stupid enough to think that the government controls the marketplace in Germany and France and in Sweden and Denmark and Norway. I mean, he's just not that stupid. This is a naked political attack on Bernie Sanders.
And the last question I had was about organizing, but I wasn't sure if it was anything more than the precinct committee chairman, and that's kind of what you said.
Yeah, that's.
So I'll just end it with.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to end it with. One thing the establishment on the Democratic side will not admit out loud, and I think they know this, because I know Tea Party people, they're all around me, they hate NAFTA, they don't like the Bushes, and they don't like the Clintons, and Bernie Sanders could get their votes, and the establishment knows that.
Yep, absolutely, and if the Republican Party would just, you know, get a clue, Bernie Sanders can do the exact same thing Ronald Reagan did. Reagan reached out to Democrats and said, particularly Southern Democrats, and mostly around race, you know, vote for me, I'll be the racist candidate. But he pulled Democrats into the Republican Party, and they have stayed there for 30 years. And Bernie Sanders as president, it would be another revolutionary moment, just like the Reagan revolution, just like the FDR revolution. And it would be a revolutionary moment. And that part of that revolution is that he would bring all those former Democrats, now Republicans, back to the Democratic Party. I really and truly believe that. Taylor, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. Billy in Wimberley, Texas. Hey, Billy.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Listen, you spent a lot of time last hour defending Bernie Sanders against these posited attacks that he's a communist. Or a socialist.
I'd say it's the other way around. I spent the time attacking the media for mischaracterizing him.
The only difference between a democratic socialist and a revolutionary communist is that the revolutionary communist is a more militant form. The social democrat believes that you can achieve all these goals for universal equality and so forth by the ballot box, where the revolutionary communist feels like you can do it at the point of a gun.
What?
But the result is the same. And the only difference between the communist and the socialist is the more militant nature of the revolutionary communist.
Yeah. Billy, you know, respectfully, when you say things like that, it just makes it obvious to everybody that you've never been to Northern Europe.
Yes, I've been to Northern Europe.
Okay.
Who wants to go the way of Northern Europe? You want to go the way of Greece?
I would. That's Southern Europe.
People
also get it that you're not really strong on geography.
And I'm just telling you.
But I would love to see, and this is, you know, Bernie was asked this. You know, I think it was on C-SPAN, but, you know, the guy said, okay, you're a democratic socialist, you know, do you want to walk that back? And Bernie was, you know, what does that mean? And Bernie says, you know, Denmark is a democratic socialist country. And the guy says, what, you want to make America look like Denmark? And Bernie said, yes, I agree.
Social Democrats are not given what they want. They will walk it over to revolutionary communism. That's what happened in the Soviet Union.
No, I'm sorry, Billy. It was the Trotskyites who, you know, I mean, again, go back to history and read the history of the Russian Revolution, became the Soviet Revolution. And then it went to basically a dictatorship. Lenin and Stalin. I mean, Joe Stalin was a dictator. This has got nothing to do with Northern Europe. It's got nothing to do with democratic socialism. And Billy, you're wrong. You're just simply wrong. And that kind of characterization, and I realize that that's what's going to come from the right. I realize that that's going to be the Drudge Report. That's going to be all over the right-wing websites, you know, and it is already. And now, you know, Chuck Todd and Chris Matthews picking up the drum, right? But it's wrong, and it's tragically disingenuous.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, anything goes, Summer, we'll be back with your calls. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Corky watching Free Speech TV in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up? Happy Monday. Corky? Oh, my. He's been there for a while. Corky, we might have had a hiccup here. Call right back. We'll get you on the air. Jerry in Yucca, Arizona. Jerry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, morning, Tom. I really love your show.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question here. You know, a few weeks back when Mr. Trump started raising this big ruckus and whatnot, the president had stated that he wouldn't turn the keys to the White House over to a crazy person. And
to what?
I'm just kind of curious. He wouldn't turn the keys to the White House over to a crazy person.
Oh, yeah. So or he was hoping not to.
I'm wondering if they would try to roll back the term limits on the president back to the FDR.
You know, Reagan wanted them to roll back the term limits too. There's a long history of presidents who are popular at the end of their second term wanting to run for a third term. And, you know, the only president to have done it was FDR. And after four terms, the Republicans were hysterical. And they amended the U.S. Constitution to say two terms only. And then when Reagan was president, they regretted it. And there was actually a lot of talk about reamending the Constitution toward the end of the second year of the second term of the Reagan presidency. I think they really didn't push it full bore because they knew that for the last 2 years of Reagan's presidency, basically, George Herbert Walker Bush had been, you know, Poppy Bush had been running the White House because Reagan was so far gone in his dementia at that point. But, I think that what Obama was saying when he said he didn't want to turn the keys over to a crazy person is he was, you know, gently referencing Donald Trump. And I don't disagree with him at all. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Cindy in Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Cindy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been watching what's been going on with MSNBC. On Friday, they cut off the Ed Show as well as now with Alex Wagner and The Cycle.
Right.
And I called into them and I asked them why they were doing this. And what they said was, well, it's all about ratings. And I told them, No, it's not about ratings. It's about basically getting rid of the outsider voice, as you've been talking about the insiders and the outsiders today.
Yep.
And they put me through to a place to record a message.
Okay.
And then I called up DirecTV, and I said, listen, MSNBC is trying to turn into another Fox News. So you need to get a more left-leaning news program on there, or you need to support free speech TV more and get them on there, and so that we have a voice for those of us.
Well, free speech TV is on DirecTV. You're watching it right now, Cindy.
Yes, free speech TV is on DirecTV, but the point of the matter is what I was trying to the point I was trying to make to DirecTV is that MSNBC is no longer any kind of a left-wing voice because they're eliminating people like Ed Schultz. So I have the phone number if people want to call into MSNBC.
Okay.
It is 212-664-4444.
Okay. Cindy, I would submit to you that there's nothing wrong with calling and registering your complaints, but they are driven by money and advertisers, not by but not by viewer feedback, unless the viewer feedback is in the form of ratings. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, if they see their ratings drop dramatically with the loss of Ed and Alex, that's going to be really telling. Thanks for the call. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com and free-don.org. And Victoria Jones is with us. And Victoria, it looks to me like you're in the basement of the White House.
I'm in the basement of the White House. That's correct.
So what's going on in the world and what's going on at the White House?
Well, the briefing was actually wasn't cut short, but it was a little short today because people are hurrying off to an event where the president will announce his new climate change rule for power plants.
And this is something that I think the whole world is cheering, but the about half of the electricity in the United States is produced by for-profit corporations, and their trade association is hysterical about this.
That's correct. They're hysterical, and a number of other people are. The Murray Energy Corporation said it's filing 5 federal lawsuits to fight the Obama administration's new climate rules for power plants,
right,
and it expects to win. The company said in a statement today, this illegal rule will adversely restructure the electric power system in America and will force every state to radically change their energy policies. It will dramatically increase the cost of electricity for all Americans with no environmental benefit whatsoever, according to Bob Murray, the company's president.
Those poor buggy whip manufacturers. You know, I mean, this is like the in 1910, the buggy whip industry yelling and screaming about that damn automobile and that damn Henry Ford. It's like, come on, the world is moving ahead. Clean energy is now actually, if you take away the subsidies for oil, clean energy, principally solar and wind, are less expensive than fossil fuels. Not to mention the damage. You know, if you include the externalities, they're more than half as expensive.
Well, my understanding is that Vermont's power company said it wanted to reduce the rates.
Yeah, 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 because the renewables are cheaper.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
And look at Germany. I mean, there was one day last week over 74% of all the electricity produced in that country. And Germany, by the way, is the cloudiest country in Europe. I used to live there, and I know. 74% of all their electricity was produced by renewable sources. Denmark has had days where they were generating like 140% of their demand. They were exporting renewable energy. They've got so many windmills.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that could be us. I mean, there's a technology. They've got shingles now that you can put on a house that are solar. We could solarize every building in America, and we wouldn't need these giant utilities. And that's why they're fighting, of course.
It's going to be an epic fight.
It is. What else is up?
Senator Chuck Schumer is teaming up with another Schumer, his cousin, actress and comedian Amy Schumer.
Oh, really? They're related. I didn't know that.
They are cousins, yes, to push for stricter gun control laws.
Uh-huh.
The two Schumers holding a news conference in New York to unveil a new proposal drafted by the senator meant to prevent violent criminals, abusers, and those with mental illnesses from obtaining guns. Now, the push comes in the wake of the shooting in Lafayette, Louisiana last month at a screening of Amy Schumer's new movie, Trainwreck, where two women were killed and at least nine other people were injured.
Right, and this by a man who is openly misogynistic, has preached hatred of women. And the first two people he murdered were the two women who were sitting in front of him. And it was a movie starring a woman. I don't think that all that stuff is a coincidence.
Right, but also clearly had a major history of mental illness.
Yeah.
So it also comes after pressure from survivors of the Newtown, Connecticut massacre. Sarah Clements, whose mother, Abby, survived the shooting at Sandy Hook, wrote an open letter to Amy Schumer, saying, I and many millennials look up to you so much. You're our generation's epitome of what it means to be a strong, powerful, self-aware champion. And then she wrote on Medium, I know deep down that the tweet you sent after the shooting was not all that you've got. And we need your voice in this movement. We need your help. So the Schumers have outlined a three-part gun control plan. The new legislation uses a carrots and sticks strategy for states to submit key records into a national background check system. States that give all the paperwork will get financial rewards, while states that don't will face penalties. They're also going to press the Justice Department to write a report and make recommendations on how states handle involuntary mental health commitment. And then they're going to push Congress to fully fund mental health and substance abuse programs.
Interesting. That's good stuff.
The Department of Homeland Security is arguing that a new cybersecurity bill that's likely to come up before the Senate as soon as today could slow responses to cyber attacks and endanger the rights of U.S. citizens. This is the Department of Homeland Security saying this.
Okay.
In a letter to Senator Al Franken, the department said the CISA Act, which would create logistical and privacy challenges. They're worried about provisions that would allow companies to share cyber threat data with agencies other than DHS. It could sweep away important privacy protections. They're also very concerned. They say it would receive a greater amount of data about hackers from the private sector. They also say that the DHS has established information sharing arrangements that CISA might actually weaken. So Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has teed up this bill to pass this week, partly, some people say, because there is a time compression element because everybody wants to get out of town. And now this letter's come in, put a bit of a wrench in the works, and it's going to be very interesting to see because privacy people are, like Ron Wyden, are already opposing this bill.
Very interesting. And when does the base get activated? When does Common Cause and, you know,
they've been activated for some considerable time opposing this bill.
Yeah, okay.
Very actively. The first thing, however, that's going to happen at 5:30 is a procedural vote to defund Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Question is, are there 60 votes to do so?
Do you think?
Key Democratic senators to watch: Bill Nelson, Michael Bennett, Bob Casey, and Mark Warner.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And happy Monday to you.
You too.
Thanks. We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. James Shirk is on the line with us. He's a research fellow and senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So The president is arguing for a gradual raise over a number of years to $10.10 an hour for the minimum wage. My understanding is that that's the point at which the Walmart, McDonald's business model of have the federal government cover most of the costs of your workers starts to fall apart, because at that level, people no longer qualify for food stamps and a lot of things. A number of politicians are calling for $12 an hour, phased in over a 5 or 10 year period. Others are calling for $15 an hour. Has there ever been a time in American history when increasing, and by the way, the minimum wage right now would be in the neighborhood of $12 an hour if it was inflation adjusted since 1968, and if it was productivity adjusted, it would be over $20 an hour right now. Has there ever been a time in American history when raising the minimum wage has caused the GDP to go down? I can't find one.
Well, I want to correct you on a few points there. On the issue of the Walmart being covered by food stamps and the like and their wages, this is actually something that Jason Furman, who's the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama, obviously, has written, pointing out, saying this simply isn't the case, that the overwhelming consensus of the academic research that's been done finds that the existence of food stamps and Medicaid and WIC and all these government welfare benefits tend to reduce the labor supply. That is, they tend to make people less likely to work. And so
I'm not buying it.
Well,
I'm not buying it. I don't think that there's anybody out there who would, you may have a small percentage, 1 or 2% who are suffering from some kind of mental illness. And you've got people who are disabled or, toward the end of their working lives who would love to get out of the workforce. But I'm not buying it. I heard that argument from Ronald Reagan. I heard that argument from Bill Clinton. And every time we tried to cut back on those programs and things, it didn't suddenly increase employment. Employment is driven by demand, as you well know, and demand is called wages. If you increase wages and you put that money not in the pockets of people like the Koch brothers, who are just going to stash in a Swiss bank account, but you put it in the pockets of working people, they're going to spend 100% of it. That's going to increase demand in the economy, which is going to increase employment.
Well, I'm telling you that the academic debate on this is, it's a question of how much does it reduce labor supply.
It doesn't.
Is it a little? Is it a lot?
No, it doesn't. Every single time the minimum wage has been raised since 1935, it has been followed by an increase in GDP. Every single time.
With respect to the welfare program, too, this is what I'm talking about here. That, again, you know, Jason Furman, you can point to Aaron Dube, who's one of the champions for arguing the minimum wage.
If that's true, James, would you support a program that says that, companies can no longer pay? I mean, are you really trying to suggest to me that a person who works a 40-hour week at Walmart or at McDonald's does not qualify for supplemental assistance of any kind?
What I'm arguing is that Walmart pays higher wages because of the existence of those supplemental programs.
No.
That it's very clear. This is an argument that's persuasive to Jason Furman, that is persuasive to Aaron Dube, one of the champions.
Well, my argument is persuasive to Robert Reich, who is the former Secretary of Labor for the Clinton administration. It's persuasive to Joe Stiglitz, who's one of the most respected economists in the world. If you want to have dueling economists, I think I've got some names that are more recognizable than yours.
Well, there's two different.
But let's talk about the principles here. Let's talk about the principles. Why are you opposed to raising the minimum wage?
Because it will hurt the people it's intended to benefit.
Where is the example of that in history?
Well, I'll give you two examples here. Now, I'll preface this by saying that very often, the minimum wage increases we've seen mostly in the U.S. have been relatively small, say from going from $5.15 an hour to $6.50 an hour. There's not an awful lot of people back when you had a $5.15 minimum wage who were making that or were making $6.50, and so minimum wage increases tend to affect relatively few people. And so I'd say there's a small effect, but you don't see an overwhelming effect. But when we've had big minimum wage increases that have affected a lot of people, you've seen a lot of economic pain. Example A would be what happened to Puerto Rico. In the 1970s, Puerto Rico got connected to the federal minimum wage, despite having incomes that are roughly a third that of here on the mainland. Now, did this lead to general prosperity? Did this lead to greater wealth? Did it lead to an economic flourishing for the island economy? Unfortunately, it didn't. What happened was their total employment fell by about 9%.
Over what period of time?
This was from between, it was basically the early 80s. So it's,
because
I want to say from 79.
Because my understanding of what has happened in Puerto Rico is that we were giving, the United States government, that we were giving corporations basically the ability to not have to pay taxes if they moved their manufacturing facilities to Puerto Rico. And that's why virtually all of the pharmaceutical industry had moved to Puerto Rico. And then that either expired or was repealed sometime in the last 6 or 8 years. And now those companies have moved their operations out of Puerto Rico. And as a result, you know, Puerto Rico's tax base has shrunk because the decent, manufacturing jobs there are gone. That it was essentially a variation on trade policy.
So in terms of what's been going on recently, that's the case. I wouldn't say that the minimum wage is the only reason Puerto Rico's in the trouble it is. There's a lot of things. But you go back to the early 80s when they pushed through the massive minimum wage hike, and that's when you saw the massive exodus of Puerto Ricans, primarily to New York, more recently to Miami. But what happened was a lot of these lower-skilled Puerto Ricans just couldn't find jobs in Puerto Rico, they have U.S. citizenship, and so they were able to move to New York with that.
So you're telling me the companies went out of business in Puerto Rico as a result of the minimum wage increase? I see no evidence of that.
Well, their employment dropped by 9%. One out of every 11 jobs in Puerto Rico went away. I mean, that's a pretty large effect. And this was by Harvard economist Richard Freeman, who analyzed
this. There's got to be – well – okay, we're not talking about Puerto Rico here. We're talking about the United States, the richest country on earth. Why? Here's the fundamental issue. Why should, in the United States of America, why should anybody who works a 40-hour week have to live in poverty?
Well, the fact of the matter is there's relatively few minimum wage workers who are actually living in poverty.
Well, you and I both know that's true, but it's also not true. If you take from the minimum wage to about a buck and a half above the minimum wage, that encompasses a hell of a lot of people. Let's refer generally to minimum wage workers as people earning under $10 an hour, okay? In that case, you're talking about a huge cohort of the American population who are earning less than in 1968 all minimum wage earners earned, because if you take in $68 and inflation adjust them to today, the minimum wage in 1968 was $12 an hour.
That's not true, unfortunately. Or it will, fortunately or unfortunately, that's simply not true. The problem with that there is you're using the less accurate measure of inflation to do that inflation adjustment.
Well, let's say it was $11 an hour then. It was still more than $7.25.
If you look at the Congressional Budget Office report that they did about a year ago, they used what's widely regarded as a more accurate measure of inflation. It's called the Personal Consumption Expenditure
and that would have
Index. And under that deflation, just you look at their chart, look at the front chart on the report, just Google Congressional Budget Office report, and you don't see the minimum wage ever getting anywhere close to $12 an hour.
So what was it?
It was about $8.50 an hour in 1968.
So from 1968 to today, we've seen so little inflation that that something back then that cost $7.25 would only cost $8.50 now.
No,
seriously trying to tell me that
was about $1.90 an hour. Using the more accurate measures of inflation, that adjusts into about $8.50 in today's dollars. The actual minimum wage was about $1.90.
Right. Okay, we're in the weeds here again. To the question, why should anybody? Oh, we're out of time. James Shirk. An interesting conversation. A research fellow, senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Thank you for coming on the program today, James.
Thank you.
Yeah, good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls right after this. And welcome back. Corky in Hilton. Let's try it again, Corky. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sitting here. How do you do this show? I'm telling you, you buy these guys' books, send them to school, and they chew the covers. Didn't Chris Matthews learn anything in school? Communism is a form of government.
Yes.
Socialism is the economic system that they operated under.
Right.
Now, under a communist system, nobody owns nothing. Everything belongs to the state, and the people work for the betterment of the state.
Right. At least in theory.
Well, that was the fact of communism.
Right.
In the 70s, 60s, 70s, and before, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That was the truth of communism. Everybody worked for the state.
Right.
Now, for him to ask Bernie Sanders that question, I got a question for Chris Matthews. Chris, are you still cheating on your wife?
What?
That's what it equates to. That's
are you still beating your wife kind of question, where however you answer it, you're screwed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
not that anybody thinks that Chris is cheating on his wife, because I don't think anybody does. But,
no,
yeah.
But that was, I'm just making a point.
Yeah, I get it.
See, what we have here is we have a golf course system of government where you get a handicap so that the same guy doesn't win the game every time.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got can afford better clubs, or he's got a nicer golf cart where he doesn't get tired out. We have a handicap system. And what they've done is eliminated the handicap. You know, they say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
How can you ask a man to pull himself up by a bootstrap when you took his bootstraps and sent him to China?
Right.
And you send him to Vietnam, and you send them to Mexico.
Yep.
What kind of person are you that would ask a man to pull his bootstraps up?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm just astonished by Chris Matthews. I'm so disappointed. Corky, I'm not surprised, but disappointed. Corky, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Dave, what's up? Dave? No, Dave. Norma, I don't have a city for you. Norma, where are you?
I'm in Montgomery, Alabama, Tom.
Great.
Like I've always been.
Oh, well, it doesn't show on the screen. We got a minute to the break, Norma. It's all yours.
Is that all? Okay. First of all, Norm, I watched the Nation's show over the weekend. It was great. I had never seen it before with Noam Chomsky. Great definition of liberal socialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, since I never can speak to my senator, I would like for the lobbyists to have to request a meeting with a senator in paper and get an invitation to come to the senator so we can keep track of what these lobbyists want with our senators, our House of Representatives, and make it a public record that we have to know why the lobbyists went to our representative and what the discussion was about.
Yeah, so well, good luck with that. I mean, most of the lobbyist activities is not walking into a senator's office and saying, hi, I'm officially here. It's taking him out to a $400 dinner. And you see it all around this city every night in the fancy restaurants. And, that's, or taking them to, the whole Abramoff scandal that Bob Ney got swept up in. You know, they take them to Scotland for a golfing tour. Norma, thank you for the call. I get your point, though. I totally agree with you. This is out of control. Thank you. President Obama is speaking as we speak about global climate change. He says there is such a thing as being too late.
This far on a gallon of gas by the middle of the next decade. Combined with lower gas prices, these standards are on pace to save drivers an average of $700 at the pump this year. We doubled down on our investment in renewable energy. We're generating 3 times as much wind power, 20 times as much solar power as we did in 2008. These steps are making a difference. Over the past decade, even as our economy has continued to grow, the United States has cut our total carbon pollution more than any other nation on Earth. That's the good news. But I am here to say that if we want to protect our economy and our security and our children's health, we're going to have to do more. The science tells us we have to do more. And this has been our focus these past 6 years. And it's particularly going to be our focus this month. In Nevada, later in August, I'll talk about the extraordinary progress we've made in generating clean energy and the jobs that come with it and how we can boost that even further. I'll also be the first American president to visit the Alaskan Arctic, where our fellow Americans have already seen their communities devastated by melting ice and rising oceans, the impact on marine life. We're going to talk about what the world needs to do together to prevent the worst impacts of climate change before it's too late. And today we're here to announce America's Clean Power Plan, a plan 2 years in the making, and the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change. Right now, our power plants are the source of about a third of America's carbon pollution. That's more pollution than our cars, our airplanes, and our homes generate combined. That pollution contributes to climate change, which degrades the air our kids breathe. But there have never been federal limits on the amount of carbon that power plants can dump into the air. Think about that. We limit the amount of toxic chemicals like mercury and sulfur and arsenic in our air or our water, and we're better off for it. But existing power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of harmful carbon pollution into the air. For the sake of our kids and the health and safety of all Americans, that has to change. For the sake of the planet, that has to change. So 2 years ago, I directed GINA and the Environmental Protection Agency to take on this challenge. And today, after working with states and cities and power companies, the EPA is setting the first ever nationwide standards to end the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from power plants.
Wow. A lot of stuff there. This is, and the president is taking science seriously, and the Republicans, of course, not only are not taking science seriously, but they can't afford to, because the people who fund them, by and large, you know, well, many of the people who fund them are oil barons. I mean, the Koch brothers, look at this oil fortune that they inherited from daddy. They got rich the old-fashioned way. The majority of really, really genuinely rich people in this country got rich the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. Anyway. And it's oil money, and so, you know, ExxonMobil has been funding this. The Kochs have been funding, you know, all these climate change denial. Well, I'm sorry, you can't deny it anymore. The jet stream is falling apart. The Arctic is going ice-free. The answer isn't to send a shell drilling rig up there. The answer is to stop drilling. Anyhow, David in Wellington, Florida. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Tom, I just wanted to, I was calling to make a point about Bernie. I wanted
sure.
to raise an issue. I think strongly reinforces your analysis of Bernie is the importance of Bernie's outsider status, which personally I think makes him by far the most likely candidate to beat the Republicans in the general election.
I agree.
I think the whole viability of Bernie's candidacy is that, frankly, our system, our whole political establishment has become so corrupt, so degraded and rotten that it's only an outsider has a shot at a moment like this. And I think there's a historical precedent. To my mind, by far, the most consequential third-party outsider candidacy in the 20th century was George Wallace. I mean, you know, you have obviously Teddy Roosevelt and Perot. I think those were more vanity efforts, really. But George Wallace was deeply consequential. And if I could just ask you, at the time that Wallace declared, among people who preferred Wallace for president, if you could guess who their second choice was among intended Wallace voters.
This was 68?
In that election.
This is the election of 68. I'm guessing their second choice was Nixon.
Second choice was Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, really?
Which is, yeah.
Who was positioning himself as an outsider? Go ahead.
Yes, who were both legitimate outsiders.
Right.
I mean, spoke to the, you know, and it also, Tom, reinforces your point about, that I agree with totally, there's no such thing these days as an independent voter. I mean, you know, God knows there are plenty of disaffected voters, people who are too busy and distracted and different to get involved, but they're not genuinely independent. I mean, there are people who are so disengaged from the whole system that just like back then, There are people who legitimately want some real outside voice, someone that they don't regard as tainted by this entire establishment and entire process.
Right. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, I think for that reason that, that people under people in the establishment, especially Chris Matthews, the Chuck Todds, the David Gregorys, etc., they actually don't appreciate how viable Bernie is in this country.
Yeah, because the he represents an opportunity to shake up the old order, and they're very comfortable and very wealthy as a consequence of the old order. And that ain't a good thing from their point of view. David, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius. We'll be back right after this. Actually, Danielle and Shana will be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I have to run and pre-tape a TV interview with Naomi Klein. I'm really looking forward to. And Danielle and Shana will be taking your calls right after the break.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano sitting in for the last few minutes for Tom as he ran over to talk to Naomi Klein. So
pretty cool.
Yeah, be sure to check that out later. The president is still speaking. We're going to check in with him momentarily and see what else is unraveling there about the Clean Power Plan. And we'll be back to your calls. So hang tight and we'll check in with the president briefly.
Acid rain threatening to destroy all the great forests of the Northeast. And you fast forward 30, 40 years later, and we solved those problems. But at the time, the same characters who are going to be criticizing this plan were saying, this is going to kill jobs. This is going to destroy businesses. This is going to hurt low-income people. It's going to be wildly expensive. And each time they were wrong. And because we pushed through, despite those scaremongering tactics, you can actually run in Los Angeles without choking. And folks can actually take a boat out on that river. And those forests are there. So we got to learn lessons. We got to know our history. The kinds of,
and I'm want to mention here that as we go back to us here, if you want to turn on Fox News, which you never should, it's very, very bad for you. They are not. That is not on the monitor right now.
So they are not covering the president's speech.
No,
I'm so shocked by that, Shano.
They aren't scientists. They are not scientists.
Nor do they want to have anything to do with scientists.
Yeah.
Lots of people have been holding for quite some time to talk to Tom,
yeah.
And while we are not Tom, we can certainly get you in, and if you want to call back to share your points with Tom as well tomorrow, you can do so. So let's check in with Jeff, maybe, listening in Denver on his computer. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Since the president thank you. Since the president mentioned gas mileage, I came across last night. An ad from 1981 for a Subaru station wagon. It got 31 miles to a gallon in the city and 44 in the highway. Much, much, much higher than we get today for the same vehicle.
Yeah, and that was 1981, you said?
Yes, 34 years ago.
Wow.
We have devolved that much. People now rave about 25 to a gallon. I was getting much higher than that in the 80s.
Yeah.
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 We had cars that got over 50 to a gallon then. We've devolved. And we're the ones buying those cars, so it's our fault.
Yeah, my father tells a story quite often about him driving a Honda during the OPEC crisis and all of his buddies laughing at him because of this little tiny, you know, funny-looking Honda. But while they were waiting in line at the gas station, he was cruising by in his little tiny Honda. So,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So the main issue, right now, yes, we want Bernie, most of us do, but he needs a team of elected officials. And we especially need to replace such dynacons such as Senator Michael Bennett here in Colorado. But anyway, oftentimes the local and state offices are more important than federal. And if we had different elected officials and 2,000 local officials, we would have had a different president. Bush would not have gotten in.
Yeah.
And so considering that Tom has millions of listeners, consider if just one in 1,000 of you who are listening right now ran for office, For every million, we'd have 1,000 candidates. So right now, we could have a few thousand candidates of just Tom's listeners running for local offices, election officials, city council, state. I mean, the state legislatures, where a lot of the huge changes are happening. And we could change the face of the country just with Tom's listeners running.
I think you're right. I think even if they weren't willing or interested in running for office, if they were just willing to get involved and to show up at their local meetings and to try and have a say in how they wanted to shape the party for the future, I think it could have big changes. And instead of sitting here debating who should be our eventual nominee, we could be debating big issues like the issues that the president is speaking about right now.
Yeah, and besides, you get paid for it, too. So you get paid to change the world.
Hey.
And one person has mentioned, hinted a little bit that he's interested, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. And I say, Paul, run. I'll be your first person to donate to you.
Yeah, well, from hopefully Paul is listening. But, Jeff,
so
right on.
This is our chance to change the world. We've got the biggest chance we've had in our lifetime. Bernie is going to be a tremendous force. But you can be a part of that force.
Yeah, so, and please, you could be a part of it even, if you're a Hillary supporter, if you're a Jim Webb supporter, you could still go out and be a part of it. I haven't encouraged, on the other side, Republicans, take back your party. You have 17 people running for office because you can't grasp what the identity of your party should be.
We have a number of friends here in D.C. who are Republicans, who are conservatives, who are thinking about running for office and like, you're so normal. You are so reasonable. Now, we don't agree on everything, but please run for office. I can have a reasonable debate with you about policies. More of those Republicans, those conservatives, I would love for them to run for office,
instead
too.
Instead of candidates with dueling Hitler analogies, because that is definitely what we need less of in this country. Jeff, it is always a pleasure and an honor speaking with you, and I think you make a great point. Tag your it. Get involved. And
so, Danielle, you're going to run for office?
I've thought about it from time to time. I don't know that I'll actually ever do it, but I will say
I know my brother wants to run for office, too.
Your brother would be a great politician.
I know. Yes. He would be.
He would. And his state could use...
Oh, couldn't they?
Yes. So, anyhow, let's jump to Larry, who's also been holding a very long time in... Jeff, thank you for the call. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, listening on 1360 AM. Larry, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program. Larry?
Hello. Let me just jump right into this. Let me make my points real quick. Tom talked a few times about hope, but hope is the last thing that was left in Pandora's box. I'd much rather have faith. The next thing I want to talk about is judges. I've been through the special masters for a particular item, and then I went to go talk to five congressmen, Waxman, Etheridge, McHenry, and Burton, and I gave them a file on what I wanted to talk about. And unbelievably, Waxman told me, Larry, this is going to take an act of Congress. I said, well, that's why I'm here.
that was, I think, one of the primary reasons you go and visit your Congress members. But sorry, go ahead, Larry.
Well, this was during a demonstration for autism. I think Jim Carrey was there that day. I walked right by him. He wasn't my issue. But I've been a witness to a lot of things. For instance, in 1996, there was two things that happened that year that nobody really paid attention to. They degraded meats and changed the since I'm a certified executive chef, I would pay attention to that. And they made a choice prime, blah, blah, blah. But they also reevaluated their IQ. They added 10 points to people for their IQ that year. I have my own reasons why they did that. That's another story. And my biggest point is at this moment is that the Congress is looking at $4 billion, getting close to $5 billion, that has been put aside in the special masters, kitty for injuries for children or anybody that for medical reasons. And it's been accumulating, and they had their eyes on it to do something with it. And what I would like to see happen is the statute of limitation for the injury that my son had was 36 months. That's a very short time.
Okay, Larry, I don't mean to interrupt you here, but you're kind of hitting on a lot of different subjects that I think are hard to follow.
All has to do with justice in the forest. And I went to Congress about this issue, and now Congress is eyeing the money that's been stored up for this particular issue I'm talking about.
And that particular issue is?
Every time I bring this up, I get cut off. But
well, Larry, there's only so much time. You only have a little bit, about a minute here. So you
it has to do with pharmaceuticals,
right?
They raised the bar so high on especially 36 months to figure out a injury. I figured it out in 40 months, and three doctors I won't mention all gave me letters after I figured it out. Say, Larry, you were right all along. But I'm just a chef. And I was right, but I did it in 40 months, and specialists couldn't do it. 36 months for statute of limitations on a
Larry, so you're saying that Congress is trying to get their hands on the money that's been set aside for people injured from vaccines, is what you're getting at?
It should be for children that have been injured, many children.
And is there somebody that people can, you know, if they're listening and they're concerned about this issue, how can they help prevent Congress from using that money, diverting it for some other purpose? Should they call their congressperson?
Well, I've already been there. They don't really want to even talk about it. That's a good question. That's a great question.
It's always the question, isn't it, Larry? That is the question. What do we do?
I've been there face to face. Well, the guy behind me had a $5,000 watch on. It's lobbyists that are just really...
Yeah, Larry, I got a bunch of other people holding here, so I think it's a very noble cause, and it's a noble issue, and Congress certainly loves to get their hands on any pile of money a lot of people aren't going to.
This is tort reform. This is when they say we're going to reform torts because of all these frivolous lawsuits out there. What they do is they decrease statutes of limitation, which means after a certain amount of time, you can't bring the lawsuit. No matter how much wrong was perpetrated against you, you can't bring the lawsuit. And when they make those really short, lots of people who have been very seriously harmed never can get the compensation for that harm.
Yeah.
That's the face of tort reform. And of course, if government's putting money away that isn't being spent because they've tort reform, they'd love to spend it on something else. Larry has a great point. How about spending it on what it was allocated for?
Right. And
one
you
of the ways to do
additional...
that, increase the statute of limitations.
Right. And if you need additional money, you don't take it from injured children. You raise taxes. What a concept. We'll be back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is Anything Goes Summer in the last few minutes here. Give us a call and share your thoughts. Welcome back to Free Speech TV, the Tom Hartman program here. Let's check in with Dave in Canton, Michigan, watching on DirecTV. Thanks for spending the day with the Tom Hartman program, Dave.
Yes, I was calling about that capitalist-socialist debate and how it relates to this election. All economies are capitalist economies. It's just a matter of not how much money is being saved, but who controls what's being saved. And that's what all the Trump voters are about. They're the tax revolters. Now, we need to get them into our camp. And I've proposed this before, $100,000, no federal income tax. Those of us on the left want national health care. We have 15% national sales tax, and we create national health care.
A 15% national sales tax, though, I mean, think about how much that would penalize those who make the least. You know, somebody living on minimum wage can't afford a 15% sales tax, and that's regressive. It's going to hurt people who spend all of their income far more than it's going to hurt people who only spend a portion of their income because they can afford to stash it away for year after year after year.
That's only if you put the sales tax on everything. We're only going to tax people's wants, not their needs. We're not going to tax food. Here in Michigan, we don't have a sales tax on food. We're not going to tax anything that they really need. There's no sales tax on that. It's only going to tax the things people want. And we can use that to direct our economy. Think of it. No tax on E85 fuel. People use E85 fuel, but they'll have to pay 15%. Tax on gasoline.
I mean, I think there's merit to the idea, but it says here you want to convince Trump voters to come to our side. How can we convince them to come to our side before somebody else is elected president? Because the type of reform you're calling for, regardless of whether somebody listening agrees, disagrees, thinks it's the greatest or the worst idea ever, it's not going to be enacted before we get our next president. So how do we get them to listen to us now, you know?
Well, we have to propose it. They are the tax revolters on the Trump side, the Republican side. $100,000, no taxes. That's what they care about. I proposed something similar to this in 2000 when Al Gore was running on C-SPAN. And on that weekend, on the Fox News Business Report, Wayne Rogers, all he wanted to do was talk about it. But the moderator there would not allow him to talk about it. Anything Fox doesn't want to talk about, we want to talk about.
It's an interesting concept. I'm of the opinion that, you know, I didn't serve in the military. I'm not volunteering my time. I'm not giving back enough to my community as I think that I should. So taxes are my patriotic contribution to this country. That's my opinion. That, you know, and I would love to see the people who constantly throw that word patriotism around, that we're not patriotic enough because we, you know, as one caller mentioned earlier, we're not wearing the right flag pin, or we're not, you know, hating the right group of minorities, whatever their original idea may be, you know. Paying taxes is patriotic, and I think we need to convince them that they should be the real patriots.
Well, everyone will pay taxes if we charge taxes on people's wants and not their needs. This will totally do what you want to do to draw people into our party.
Well, Dave, it's certainly an idea, and you know, maybe we could get some callers' thoughts on it. I know we probably won't have time today, but... get other people's opinion on another day. But thanks for watching DirecTV and for spending time with the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Danielle here with Shano. Tom had to run out a few minutes early, but we are taking your calls, doing our best to hold down the fort, and he will be back tomorrow. Let's check in with Sean in Kenilworth, New Jersey, listening on the Tom Hartman app. Sean, you gave me this point earlier, and I think my jaw literally went slack.
Well, unfortunately, in New Jersey, we're kind of used to him saying those ridiculous things. Chris Christie saying that the teachers union deserves a punch in the face. That's nothing new to us, especially, you know, I'm a teacher. My wife's a teacher. We've been berated by that man since 2009. Whether it's him not funding our pensions, whether it's him flip-flopping on Common Core, spending $28 million on the park examination, which is, number one, an unfair standardized test for a number of reasons, but they're going to probably repeal that in a couple of years, not even counting, you know, quote-unquote, officially counting this year or next. But the problem that I think is a bigger problem with Chris Christie and the things that he says, and I know he's only polling at about 3%. You know, he's representing the Koch brothers' agenda, and so does Scott Walker. Scott Walker sees teachers and teachers' unions and public workers' unions and labor unions the same way that Chris Christie does. So this narrative that he keeps drumming away at is something that, you know, Republican candidates who are more likely to win the presidency, like a Scott Walker, their beliefs align with Chris Christie. But no, it's nothing that surprises us anymore. I mean,
no.
There's videos that you can go on YouTube and see him screaming at teachers.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I think with most of the candidates, this is part of the crazy off to getting
exactly
to Fox's
what I was
debate.
Say.
But this doesn't seem too abnormal for Chris Christie.
Right. Well, it's hard to yell louder when you've already been at 11 for the last 6 or 7 years, when you've been screaming and screaming and chewing people out in public as part of your normal day-to-day life. He can't get any louder. So that's, I think, why he's having such a hard time moving up in the polls to get into that debate on Thursday night. This was his attempt, punching a teacher in the face. That visual, we're talking about him, aren't we? When's the last time we talked about Chris Christie?
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah,
honestly,
since Bridgegate. But it, you know... I have to, you know, stand on the fence on this. Just one point of honesty, that I often use a turn of phrase of jokingly saying so-and-so needs to be punched, so-and-so needs to be punched. So I've probably said that expression, but I don't actually mean it intentionally. I don't actually mean any harm to anyone.
And you're also not a large man, and you're also not running for the presidency of the United States of America,
right,
at least at this moment.
Right.
I realized last segment you said you might run for office. But
trying to be fair.
But not now.
trying to be fair. But, Chris, do you think he has any chance of actually getting elected, getting seen as one of the top-tier candidates, Sean?
No, but I'm a Bernie supporter. I've had his lawn sign out on my lawn since he announced that he was running. But the bigger another problem here is that, I mean, in New Jersey, we just passed the HIV laws a couple of years ago, the anti-bullying laws. We teach our students that it's not right to intimidate somebody else and make them feel inferior and to harm them, whether through physical violence or verbal, to berate them verbally. This is the guy who's, the most powerful man in our state, basically doing the things that we teach our kids not to do. And it's just, I just think it's just so vile and disgusting that guys like him and guys like Scott Walker get away with the things that they say. Not only because it's going to, it's affecting me professionally, it's affecting teachers professionally, but I mean, it's hurting the kids.
Yeah.
They see this and they think this is right. But one more thing, the Koch brothers would love to see public education in this country destroyed. They would love to see it destroyed. They'd love to see my wife and I getting paid, $20,000 a year and living like paupers.
Right.
That's their agenda.
See, I don't think they even care about public education versus private education. I don't think they really care about the teachers' unions.
Well, remember when the Koch ran as vice presidential candidate, part of the platform for the Libertarian Party was to get rid of the Department of Education.
Right, but I think this is much more about trying to kill any funding to Democratic candidates.
Hmm, yeah.
I think it's much more, their whole orchestrated attack on teachers' union is much more about trying to limit any funding to potential Democratic presidential candidates. So, Sean, excellent point. I think somebody should ask Chris Christie about that at tonight's debate in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire union leader is sponsoring the actual first Republican debate, and that's happening tonight. You could check it out over on C-SPAN at 6:30 or 7 o'clock, or you can listen tomorrow, as I'm sure Shane will probably have some clips for this show.
I plan on recording it.
So, thank you for listening to the Tom Hartman app there in Kenilworth, New Jersey. And thanks to everybody. Still have a minute?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I gave you a bad cue in the middle of your little rant there, so we can take another caller.
Oh, okay.
That was my fault. Bad math.
Shano, let's check in with Don on freespeech.org in Weston, Wisconsin. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Don.
Quick comment.
Okay.
I paint word pictures, okay? Let me give you a picture.
Okay.
This is based on Supreme Court Justice Scalia warns of U.S. internment camps. I'm going to take a Troy, Michigan approach to a library and books, all right? We're going to put all women, children, non-white males in the camp, okay? And we're going to post signs on our houses in front that state this, okay? I think we would get some people up in arms, and it'd be about us for a change. All right?
So just to back up, you're saying that Antonin Scalia believes in FEMA camps?
Yes.
Wow. I'm sorry, Don, we're out of time for the rest of your imagery there, but
that
in and of itself...
That was definitely the punchline right there.
Yeah, that, I think, in and of itself, painted a pretty clear picture of what's wrong with our Supreme Court. And yet another important reason why we need to elect a Democratic president in 2016. So thanks to everybody today. Tom will be back tomorrow taking your calls with more of Anything Goes Summer. So see you then.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.